Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem. Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of this beautiful little podcast of mine. How's it going for you? I hope it's going well. I hope your day is going as brilliantly as mine is, and as mine will be as well. I spent the weekend in Belgrade, Serbia, at the Epic IT Connect conference, which is led and driven by two women, both named Milisha, and designed to promote the local Serbian IT community. It was epic. I mean, truly, truly amazing. So I really enjoyed the show, and I hope to return one day, and I hope to see that amazing burgeoning community blossom ever bigger. Unfortunately, I think all my rough traveling has finally caught up to me. And so right around the last day of my time in Serbia, I fell ill. And that's not good. My fault, obviously, for running too ragged. But it caught up with me. Last week was a tough week, after all. I was in Cape Town in Johannesburg, South Africa. I flew there from New York City, from the Kafka Summit, and I also had a brief 25-hour excursion to another country called Mauritius for another conference there. So that was all in like 6-7 days. So, you know, it's natural that it would catch up to me, but it did. And so that's kind of a bummer. So that meant that I left Serbia to come here to China, where I am right now. I'm sitting in beautiful Hangzhou, China. It meant that my journey from there to here was labored because I was kind of ill it meant that I had to go to see a doctor in Belgrade. And, you know, that's, if you travel too much, as some have accused me of doing, one of the kinds of tourism with which you become accustomed is visiting doctors, right? I'm always interested to see how the healthcare system welcomes or receives foreigners who are sick. And turns out most of them are very friendly. So that's nice. Anyway, I arrived here in China yesterday, 24 hours ago, at least. No, I'm sorry. I arrived here Wednesday, China time. So you're going to hear this podcast presumably on Friday or late Thursday, depending on where in the world you are. And I arrived here early on Wednesday morning Tuesday morning in China, in Shanghai. And then from there, I spent a day sleeping, basically. I was sick in my hotel. And then from there on Wednesday, I took a train. That's Wednesday morning. And I took a train from Shanghai to Hangzhou, where on arrival, I just slept some more, right? And I must be really sick. I'm getting better, of course. And I've got a medicine thanks to my trip to the doctor in Serbia. But boy, oh boy, that's just a good reminder that you should always take a nap when your body needs it, right? It's better for you. It's better for me. It's better for your immediate family and the people that are in your immediate orbit, your team, etc. And of course, for the code, it's also better for the code if you're clear headed and rested and so on and healthy. So I'm here in Hangzhou to talk to engineering folks at Alibaba who are all in on Reactive and, of course, all in on Spring. They're particularly keen on rSocket as well. So that's kind of interesting. By the way, speaking of that, have you seen the latest installment of Spring Tips, my friends? I published that out of sequence. I published it as quick as I could, as soon as I could find literally just an hour to sit down and quietly record it in between my travels last week. I published it at the usual location, right? So bit.ly/spring-tips-playlist. And that'll take you to the YouTube channel where you can learn more about it. And there I detailed that just landed on master support for rSocket messaging and rSocket messaging in Spring Boot 2.2 and in Spring Framework 5.2. This is good stuff, and I've been keenly waiting for all this to land, and I'm so glad it's all finally here. That's good news. That's from earlier this week. And of course, yesterday, despite my being sick, the one thing I'm proud of, the one thing that got done that I've been keenly waiting to get done was I finally announced the pre-release version of my new book called Reactive Spring. It's now available on leanpub.com, reactive-spring, right? Or you can just go to reactivespring.io, no hyphens or anything like that. And you can find the link to the book there on LeanPub, where, of course, I've got a PDF, .mobi, and a .epub edition. And I'm looking into print-on-demand alternatives as well. So that's exciting. People seem to really like it. It's obviously not done yet. That's the whole point with LeanPub is it's a pre-release. It's a couple hundred pages now, and it's not, I would say it's I would say it's a little bit more than half done. Maybe, you know, it's kind of hard to know until I get there. But I'm making good progress. I've been working on this book pretty steadily since the end of last year, and I expect the rest will come much more naturally now that things are starting to firm up around the RSocket support and Spring Framework 5.2. Anyway, enough with that, my friends. We've got a really exciting show ahead of us, as always. Always a very exciting show. Today, we're going to be joined by the one, the only, the amazing, the inimitable, Matt Stein. Matt's a field CTO at Pivotal and one of the most interesting folks with whom I've had the privilege of working. He's into all sorts of things, architecture and cloud native and continuous delivery, and I was super happy to have the chance to talk to him last week. We actually sat down in Johannesburg, South Africa. So thanks, Matt, for joining me. And as always, everybody, enjoy. Reach over there and hit save because I don't trust computers.
I mean, me either.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing.
Computers are terrible.
They're terrible. There's no evidence that they have been a good idea.
Computers were a mistake.
They were a mistake. They are continually a mistake. That sound you might have heard that sounded like flatulence, that was actually a motorcycle in the background. You know why we can hear that motorcycle? Matt Stein, my guest today, you know why we can hear that motorcycle?
Why?
Because we're in Johannesburg, South Africa, as we record this. That's pretty cool, huh?
It is pretty cool. First time I've ever been to Africa.
First time I've ever been to South Africa.
Definitely that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, first time all the things related to Africa.
Right. No, that's
for
cool.
Me.
Yeah.
For me.
First time I've ever been to South Africa. I've been to Morocco, which is North Africa. And, you know, you've seen the map, right? I'm sure you've seen the map where they show, like, what you could fit inside the continent.
Yes.
Right. And so when I say North Africa, I might as well say Europe. I might as well say, like, you know, South America. It is so far away from here, you know.
Right on.
It is. So, yes, they're all technically part of Africa, but there's nothing. They're not the same in any way except for that one continent. Right. They're so far away. There's so much culture, so much diversity between here and there, you know.
Absolutely.
And a 10-hour flight top to bottom. I mean, it's just crazy.
Well,
crazy
I mean, it's insane because when I was looking at the trip, and I saw that, you know, we're actually equivalent to Central European time.
Right.
And yet I flew more than twice as long to get here.
Right.
So, in fact, this is the furthest south that I've been since I went to Australia in 2014.
Right.
But, yeah, it's quite crazy. And it's really crazy that I'm awake right now because the 15-hour flight. That's to get here just happened like a minute ago.
Right. And so I, in my infinite wisdom, I basically mat-nabbed you and took you right off the plane. It's like, we got to record a podcast. And you were like, no, I haven't slept. And I'm like, yeah, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. So I appreciate you doing this, by the way. I should say that.
I'm happy to do it, Josh. I really am.
For those of you who don't know, our guest today is Matt Stein. What do you do, buddy? What's your thing when you're not in South Africa on podcasts?
Basically, I am paid to be smart and share my opinions.
Is that your title?
No, not at all. They call me a field CTO, a global field CTO, because we go around the globe.
Yeah.
And my role is primarily to act as an advisor to leadership in software delivery organizations. So I'll work with, you know, VPs of engineering or enterprise architecture, sometimes CTOs, CIOs. And, you know, we're doing the whole digital transformation, app modernization, cloud native architecture, all of those things. kind of rolled up into one. But my focus is really on strategy. Yeah. And then on like, how do you take practices that, you know, seem to make sense quite well in like a relatively small to medium sized, maybe a web company, and say, well, let's scale that out to 30,000 developers inside one of the world's largest banks. What does it look like to actually make that happen?
And for whom do you do this?
I do this for Pivotal.
Oh, so you work at Pivotal.
So I work at the same place that you do, Josh.
Small world. I don't know. I want our audience to know that he's ours. You can't have him.
It's true.
So it sounds like you're out there fighting the good fight, right? Basically, we need people like you because you're sort of one of these. You're one of the people that are out there, very visible, very sort of in the middle of everything at Pivotal. So you have a good sort of visibility into what's happening in the organization and what's happening in the ecosystem, and and you can communicate all that back to the people that make changes in their respective organizations.
Yeah, I'm kind of like one of the top down people. I mean, for a long time, I was trying to, as an engineer, architect, senior lead, whatever you want to talk about, building practices out from the bottom up, which is a good thing to try to do.
Absolutely.
But you will eventually hit a ceiling to where if you do not have support from your leadership to actually do these things, then there's going to be a limit.
Right.
And so now my role has kind of shifted to be more of a top down kind of talking about the same exact thing, same approaches, you know, what's continuous delivery, all the things to the cloud. Right.
Right.
And but from a leadership perspective, and what does that mean from a, you know, a business outcome kind of perspective? What does that mean from, you know, economic outcomes that the company is going to be able to achieve that they otherwise wouldn't be able to achieve? And all those things, you know, maybe weren't top of mind for me when I was, you know, cutting code every day as a developer, but honestly were just as important then. I just didn't know it.
Right. And these are also things maybe I think as you got to be a good developer, as you got to be an architect, these things became more visible to you, right? They were certainly, I think when I think about a good architect, I think about a developer that understands the context, the business context in which she or he operates.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. Like, I mean, an architect is a person who can have one foot very firmly planted in both sides of that conversation. Like, I don't believe in architects that don't write code.
No, that's weird.
Architects don't belong on the critical path.
Sure.
But they should be in a very hands-on, roll your sleeves up and get your hands dirty way involved in the technical outcomes and direction of the software that's being produced. But also, like, you now have this whole other set of skills.
Yeah.
That you pick up, and you're kind of bridging the gap to, you know, the economic realities and the business realities, and being able to, in some cases, like, you know, be the person that can kind of like broker conversations and relationships across all of that. And it's a really hard job.
Yeah, it is.
It's not a I mean, it was a job that I aspired to, but I had no idea how hard it was going to be once I started doing it.
Well, plus it requires you to, by definition, see the big picture, which is super hard to do when your every instinct tells you to sort of micro optimize, right? To focus on these local outcomes.
Yeah, you have to learn to think in systems. You have to learn to think in like none of these things are actually isolated.
Right.
From one another. As much as you would like them to be, they're not.
Right.
And so, you know, you make small changes in one part of a system or in one part of an organization. Now you have to look at what is going to be the kind of cascading effect that goes across. You know, we talk about this when we're talking about, you know, like microservices, and we talk about cascading failures, and we need circuit breakers to be able to kind of like, you know, make it possible to stop those failures from cascading across an entire system. Well, you have, you know, not necessarily equivalent patterns, but you have, you know, very much the same idea when you're talking about the socio-technical system that is the software and then the people who are collaborating to produce that software. It's really the older I get in this industry, the more I realize it's very difficult to separate those.
It's more about people than people realize.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, they, because when you look at small micro problems, like software problems, code problems, you know, it's very tempting for a lot of people to say, I know I can knock that out today. I can fix that. I can scratch that itch. I can fix that bug today and completely ignore the larger systemic issue in the system, right? And that it's hard to look at the big picture. It's hard to take responsibility for the outcomes at the systems level when you know you could spend your time making the best code that does the wrong thing, right?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
It's so easy just to do the wrong thing, but it's productive. You're very productive in doing the wrong thing, you know?
Yeah, it's absolutely, absolutely dead on. Like, and you know, having experienced that firsthand,
yeah,
as a developer, it's like
first, second, and third hand. Yeah,
it's like I'm doing my thing. I'm writing my test. I'm writing my code. I'm checking off my Jira tickets or whatever it is.
You got your keylog.
And then you kind of look up and you look around and you realize, well, the project or the program or the product, whatever it is, the P word that we're building,
right?
Like it's not healthy.
No, it's not what they wanted.
No,
you're surrounded by fire and you're the dog.
Or even though your code works, yeah, when you plug it into the larger system, it doesn't work together with everything else.
Right. And you've lied to yourself. You said, well, my tests are green. Surely this will work in the integration. Not so much. Yeah. And I think that's a fit.
Software's hard.
You don't say. Yeah. Okay. I mean,
if it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Well, pack it up, boys. We have to go home. Yeah. No more of this for us. But no, I'm with you. Yeah. It is really hard. I appreciate anybody who's done it long enough to appreciate the big picture, because it's, I think, you know, there's a reason why we train people just to do the software, because that's not easy, right? Nobody said that's easy. And even once you've gotten past, can I make my code compile? Am I using the right syntax? You know, what is an object? What is a function? What is a variable? Whatever, you know, once you've gotten past that, you're still, there's very much this whole sort of ecosystem to do with the tools of the trade, right? There, you know, you could spend years just trying to understand the magic of NPM, for example, or Spring, or yeah, something like that, right? But then once you've gotten past that, to see where these things figure into the larger picture.
Well, I think a lot of it is inherent in the idea that we don't really actually have a profession yet. Yeah. Like when you think about, you know, what are we paying attention to? As the years have gone by, you know, the technology sets or frameworks or languages or platforms that you need to be acquainted with to be successful and get hired and make money,
yeah,
as a software developer have constantly been moving around. But there's been very little attention paid to, but relatively,
right,
little attention paid to what the heck is it that we actually do?
Right.
And how should it be done? And why do certain things work and why do certain things not work? And, you know, are there things that we all need to know to be able to do software engineering well?
Right.
Right. And, you know, you kind of look at other fields and, you know, whether it's, you know, the medical field or the legal field or different disciplines of engineering, right, that are, quite frankly, you know, decades or in some cases centuries more mature,
right,
than what we do. It looks very different. Like, you know, you don't see, you know, you don't see a bunch of lawyers arguing about how is it that we actually conduct this type of case,
right,
that we're doing, or this particular type of law. That's kind of established.
Right.
And so within that framework, you go do the thing that you do. But we're constantly arguing about, well, you know what? We don't like the tools that we used yesterday. Right. We're going to use these tools instead. Right. And if that's all we focus on, then it feels like the state of the art in what we're able to do as a team or as an organization at scale has actually not moved that much. It feels like it looks very much like it did at the beginning of my career. And that's kind of frustrating to me.
And it feels a bit, to liken it back to that point, it would be a bit like if in the judiciary people were still arguing about the gavel that the judge used. You know,
right?
This is not an interesting discussion. Like, who cares? Move on. You know?
I don't like the robe that you're wearing right now. And why are you not wearing a powdered wig? Because the cool judges we saw last week, they had powdered wigs.
And those are the best wigs. Yeah, totally.
The very best wigs.
And I think also, likening it back to another sort of stitch in time, because we don't have a definition, there's no hardcore sort of understanding of what we're doing and what it is, because we've had this sort of nebulous definition of what it is, I feel like there's been this void that has to be filled. And of course, business being risk averse, naturally, they're looking for people that pretend or purport at least to know what it is that we're doing, right? So these vendors, these three-letter vendors, right, come in and they have their barrage of consultants, and they say, we know what we're doing.
We know, and
just like the what was the big thing that Gutenberg did, right? He commoditized that book for everybody, right?
Yeah.
He made it so that it wasn't just the monks that knew how to do it, knew how to read it, right? It was everybody. Well, in the beginning, I feel like, especially, you know, in the 1970s, you see a lot of big organizations starting to dip their feet into computers, into digitization, and they've been looking for ways to move forward with that, and they trusted these big vendors, and these vendors said, "We know. Don't worry. You don't have to know. We do." Right,
and if so, they're not trusting the vendors, they're trusting the analysts.
Right, but either way,
people that are like, we're not even in your context.
Right,
we don't know your business.
We're not even your business, but they're chief
this
architects.
This is what you need to do.
Right, yeah, and they become in effect resident chief architects, but they're not. They're going to sell you some terrible vendorware based on golf games instead of like actual requirements. Right, so this has created a situation where we now have this really bad taste in our mouth from all these terrible consultants, right? And on the other hand, what's happened in the last 20 years? You've seen open source. You've seen, you know, it's now, there's no reason why, apart from other societal factors like income inequality, there's no reason why somebody couldn't get on a computer and build something for the App Store and build something on the server side in the cloud, right? I mean, there's a cost there, sure. But compared to 10 years ago, compared to 20 years ago, it's nil almost, right? It's very approachable. So now the question is, now we've got all these people who are hopefully, you know, starting in their free time and they're making a habit and then a hobby and then a career of these things. Now we've got this question of, well, what is it, right? If it's not the vendors, and now it's just a free-for-all, and we've got this incredible, wonderful, burgeoning community.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword because, like, you know, the access has never been greater,
right,
to the ability to take, you know, a laptop and an internet connection and create something of value.
Value, yeah. Like
been more accessible. And yet at the same time, by making that access so broad, and there's really, again, there's no definition of what good software engineering looks like versus bad software engineering looks like, and what are the ethical considerations that go into that, and, you know, what are you responsible for? You know, I produce this piece of software and somebody goes and uses it and then they get into like a bad situation or somebody gets hurt. Like, who's actually...
I think we know what bad software... I think most of us, it's like that old yarn about pornography.
But we don't agree.
Well, but I mean, well, we all agree. No, I mean, there's... Most of us know what... You know that old yarn about pornography. I know it when I see it, right? We know what bad software is. Most of us know what that is when we see it. But what's good software, right?
But even like... I was teaching a class a few months ago, and I have this, you know, this code base that we work with, and there are labs, and you make test paths, and there's all this interesting stuff. And I had a group of people that said, this code base is really well engineered, well structured. It helped me to understand the patterns that we were learning in the class. And then on the other hand, I had some people who said, this is the most over-engineered piece of crap I've ever seen. And I can't imagine anybody would ever, with any intelligence, write code that looks like this. It's very mean.
Wow.
But, you know, like, yeah, no, when you can fill out an anonymous evaluation, people... You know, all of a sudden get really unfiltered in the stuff that they say. But I don't care about that. Like, it doesn't hurt my feelings. But the fact that you have these polar opposite camps that looked like the same artifact and came to dramatically different conclusions.
Right.
And again, I'm not saying that I want everybody to be like carbon copies and we all agree that software should be exactly this way. But I feel like there's a spectrum of, you know, anarchy to, you know, like fascism.
Right.
And the defining what good software looks like. And the valuable point is somewhere in the middle.
Absolutely.
And, you're right. And I just don't think we've found that yet in a way that at least, you know, a majority of practitioners actually can say, oh, this is the thing.
Yeah.
So let's stop arguing about what the thing is and let's figure out how to get better at the thing.
So, but I think, so since we don't know, since it's very hard to quantify good versus bad, I think a lot of us have just said, and I think you would agree with this, right? A lot of us have just looked for things that we can agree on a small level that are viable, right? And we call those patterns.
Yep.
Right? So we look for things that are reproducible, that have proven to be successful in certain contexts for others, and we document those contexts and the approach, and we call it a pattern, right? And so,
I mean, you think about it, like if we want to cross a river or a gully or ditch, whatever, it's like we don't argue about like what, you know what? The thing that works in this situation is a bridge.
Right.
Now, there are different types of bridges. Yeah. Like every implementation of bridge looks a little bit different than the other ones, just like every implementation of software pattern maybe looks a little bit different than the others. But we're not arguing about whether we should use a bridge
right.
in this situation or not. And so, like, we see the same problems happening over and over and over and over again in software. We probably shouldn't keep approaching the same problem in a completely new way
right.
every single time, because at that point you're like, oh, well, there's this prior art over here. We're just going to ignore that right. and we're going to go do it this way. And, you know, that seems illogical at face value, but then
wasteful, if nothing else.
You think about it from an economic perspective. It's yeah. like, oh, well, that thing was available that would have solved this problem. So, you know, I'm being paid to solve problems for this company,
right?
And they probably want me to use my time and effort in the most efficient way possible. Well, reinventing the same solutions over and over and over again to the same problems, not very efficient.
Right. And so this gets this, I think, brings us back to our old friend James Waters, right, who talks about the value line and like the idea that, you know, don't run what you can't charge for, right?
Yep.
Like, where do you decide whether I should buy or build? How do you approach that spectrum?
I mean,
for a business.
So I feel like the conversation in the domain-driven design community around this is really illustrative. They kind of talk about, you know, the different subdomains that exist within an organization, and you kind of have this spectrum of, you know, core subdomains, you know, things that are like your competitive differentiator against other organizations that are in your particular market segment or industry vertical. The other end of the spectrum is like generic stuff that everybody has to do.
Right.
Like you need a piece of software to keep up with all the employees' payroll in the company.
Right? That sounds valuable, yeah.
I mean, it's really important. You have to do it. But if you do payroll better than the other company in your industry vertical, probably not going to be the definition of survival. And then you got different things in between.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, you need to be focusing as far towards that core competitive advantage side of things as possible from a build perspective, because you know, you're trying to differentiate. And so by definition, if you're trying to differentiate, you're trying to innovate, you can't just go buy something off the shelf and do it that way. But on the other end of the spectrum, like, you probably should be building your own payroll software, because that's a waste. Because A, getting payroll software right is actually fairly complicated. And so you're going to have to invest significant time and resources, dollars into that. And those are time, resources, and dollars that you're not investing into all that core competitive advantage stuff.
And payroll software is one of those things where it's just, it's ongoing with regulations changing and all
right.
that.
Right. And you're not an expert in that.
Yeah. Why bother?
Yeah. I mean, there are whole organizations that exist for the purpose of providing good, accurate, compliant, secure payroll software, and that's not you
yeah.
in most cases.
Hopefully. Unless that actually is you, in which case, yeah, focus on it. And so So, okay, we've got this discussion of what we should build. And I know at Pivotal, one of the big things that we do is tell people what not to build, right? That's
sure.
We're very happy if one of our customers comes to us and we can find or define the thing that will help them make a difference. I know that Pivotal turns down, you know, deals because we don't want to help people build something that is just pointless. It's not going to help them on their journey, right?
Absolutely.
And so
we're looking at it in terms of outcomes. Like, yeah. Like there is at the end of the day, software is a means to an end.
Right.
In the vast majority of cases. It's not something that's like, oh, okay, I built this thing and it's
so pretty. I just want to leave it there.
It has inherent value.
Right.
It does not. Like the value is in what problem does it solve? What opportunity does it give to the business that it didn't have before?
Yeah.
Right. And so like if you're not focused on that, then
what are you doing?
Because the other stuff, presumably everybody's got to do it. Like, you know, we had the conversation a couple years ago about, you know, operations and that being like, you know, the secret sauce in an organization. But at the end of the day, like if you think about it, you know, good operations, good platform management, good use of infrastructure, all these different things, like the stuff that makes the software have a place to live,
right,
and to survive and thrive. That is something that everybody has to do. So if you do that really, really well, congratulations, you know, you are now viable, but that still doesn't mean you're going to survive. You still have to go do all the other value driven stuff on top of that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's important that you're good at that, but it's not. And so you want to look at, well, what is the most efficient way that I can achieve a certain level of maturity and capability in terms of being able to create, again, that ecosystem in which, oh, my application developers that are trying to create this value, here's my software. And here's where it needs to live, and here's where it's going to do all the things that it's supposed to do. Creating that thing has to exist, but ultimately everybody has to have one.
Right.
And so you could go build it. You go build it.
Right.
Then, hey, that means they're not working on something that has any relation whatsoever to my industry vertical.
Yeah.
Whereas if I go and say, well, let me go purchase that, and you know, I mean, this is not a Pivotal commercial right now, but at the end of the day, like, you need to, you know, get those things that reasonably should be like somewhat like more of a commodity,
yeah,
like something that's below that line of value, and say, okay, I'm gonna buy this stuff so that I can build that stuff that creates value and sit it on top of that, and hopefully over time the line keeps creeping further and further and further up the stack.
Yeah.
To where, you know, eventually there's this dream one day where it's like, oh, I don't have to think about anything but business logic.
Yeah.
And the rest of the concerns are just taken care of. Yeah. I mean, you know, 4GL, it was only evil because we could never get it right.
Right.
Right. If we could ever actually get it right,
that would be the end game. That's what we want.
Yeah.
This reminds, what do you think of Simon Wardley and his, you know, his value line maps, or his value maps, I think that actually is a good way of capturing.
So, I'll admit some level of ignorance to how the mapping stuff actually works. But the conclusions that he will often draw from these analyses, that he will, you know, go on a, you know, a 30 or 40 tweet storm about, like, I read it and I'm like, yeah, this makes perfect sense. Now, sometimes I think he's often so far ahead of everybody that nobody can understand it. And so therefore they can't catch up. And if somebody does understand and they jump on it, like, there you go. You're going to find somebody that's going to significantly disrupt whatever it is that they're doing.
Right.
But, For the most part, I feel like, you know, the conclusions, they make sense. Then in hindsight, it's fairly obvious. But at the same time, like, I'm in so many organizations on a regular basis where they're just trying to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
And so, and that takes so much effort because of so many, I don't want to say poor decisions, but like suboptimal decisions that have been made over time.
Yeah.
That like, and you make one of those, no big deal, but you make tens or hundreds or thousands of those decisions over time, and they just compound into this thing. It's like, you can't just turn it off. You can't say, okay, delete all the bad stuff.
Nope.
Because now there's nothing to run the organization. So you have to figure out how to take that thing that you've created and
change it.
Yeah. You now, have evolve it in the direction that it needs to go bit by bit.
This, so that actually brings up another, you know, let's pull it back in a little bit from the architecture astronaut
sure.
level to code more or less, or at least components in a system where you and I as developers might spend some time. If I have a large system and we have, I saw a thing on the Twitter, and you know, they can't lie on Twitter. It's impossible, right? It's against the law. So they nobody lies on Twitter.
Nothing false ever happens on Twitter.
Never. So today I saw a thing on the Twitter.
It's not on mine.
No. So today I saw a thing on the Twitters where somebody made the great point, which is, you know, bugs are, software bugs are like real bugs. If you leave them alone, they'll get bigger. So it's better to get rid of the bugs when they're small, so that they don't cause cascading failures later on. And I think the reason that small bugs can cause so much trouble later on if you don't get them early and often is because your systems become so intertwined that there can be this cascade effect. And so the question then is, how do I take a large monolithic system and decompose it so that I can reduce the surface area for a given bug and for vulnerabilities, and also so that I can make it easier for people who are struggling to sort of evolve this giant code base? How do I make it easier for teams, which at the end of the day is the real unit of productivity here? How do I make it easier for teams to sort of wrestle with a large code base? How do I decompose it into small ways?
I want to answer that question, but I want to answer.
Okay.
I want to twist it a little bit at first, because since you decided to bring up the concept of bugs, I had an interesting interaction with it was actually Charity Majors on
Mipsy
Twitter.
Tipsy or Tipsy?
Yeah, Mipsy Tipsy on Twitter. She was talking about bug-free software, LOL.
Lol.
Like, basically, right? That there's no such thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, and so if you pretend to have, like, someone made the comment that, well, if I'm writing software to run airplanes, that I want to make sure that it's bug-free before it goes on the plane. And I'm like, well, you can't.
Yeah.
And then let's back up from that a moment and say, well, what actually is a bug?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you could say, well, when the software doesn't do what it was supposed to do. Okay, fine. Where do we figure out what it was supposed to do? Like, there's the explicit requirements, and then there's like the implicit requirements, and there's all these other things. And then you look at it from, all right, well, is it a bug? Is it that we planned to do this and we didn't? Or is it some edge case that we never even conceived of before? Or is it like some chain of causality from here to here to here to here to here that we couldn't even have foreseen because the system was so large?
I think you just asked a really deep question. And have you ever seen Brian Cantrell's discussion on what is software? It gets into this metaphor.
Probably, but I'm not sure.
Oh, it's too deep for this late hour, my
sure.
friend. But anyway, you go on. I'm just,
what else is?
Yeah.
You know,
like, what is
not too deep? Yeah. What time is it anyway?
Oh, it's later than earlier.
I mean, it's starting to get suspiciously into the evening
right.
on the time zone that I started on.
Right.
So coming back to the whole decomposition idea, like, I think that there's some very simple ideas that turn out to be very difficult to implement as you grow.
Right.
As you know, just in terms of size, like the amount of software we have, the amount of people that we have working on that software. And so we have this idea that layers are this really good thing, right? Yeah. So we divide our software up into layers because we want to separate concerns, because separating concerns is obviously a good thing to do. And then I say, well, okay, why do we want to separate concerns? Because, oh, because we want to be able to vary the details of this one thing without necessarily having this other thing have to have knowledge of that. So, hey, I've got my data layer, and I've got my service layer, and I've got my controllers and my views and all these different things. And what's interesting about that is we separate all these technical concerns, but the more responsibility that we give for different capabilities of the business to that piece of software, every single one of those layers has to know something about every single thing that the business touches.
Right.
And so without even being aware of it, we're decoupling one set of things, and then we're tightly coupling another set of things. And so we say, well, which one of those two things would be more valuable? Is the value in this sort of horizontal decomposition where, okay, I could go say, you know what? I don't like Postgres anymore. Let me put Cassandra in place.
Do you do that often?
No.
No, of course
not. One time in my career.
Have you read database?
Have I switched out a database in that way? And that was when I was told that I needed to kill Oracle in favor of Postgres solely because we couldn't afford Oracle. I was working in a nonprofit at that point in time. And so there's a very real economic consideration. It's like, we don't have the money for this, so we need to go do this. And it's fine.
And the abstraction you would have gotten from moving from one SQL, unless you're doing some seriously Oracle-y Oracle PLP SQL style kind of things, that's not such a big move.
In some cases we were.
Yeah.
But there are companies like at the time we engaged with Enterprise DB.
Yeah.
Because they had built a layer that would help with a lot of those things from a compatibility perspective. And that was helpful. But at the end of the day, like if I'm just using, we'll say, ANSI SQL standard for most things through a JDBC driver.
That is your abstraction.
There's very little that you're going to get out of that that's not already built into the tools that you're going to use by default.
Right.
So set that aside. What about the vertical decomposition of, like, I have a customer management concern or an ordering concern or an inventory concern, a shipping concern, a payments concern, features, like I'm going to have to build those.
Right.
And I know we say don't guard against change because you don't know what change is going to happen.
Right.
Well, I do know one thing that's definitely going to happen is that the business is going to want new capabilities, and they're going to want to be able to change existing capabilities. And so if I can build a piece of software in such a way that I don't necessarily know what those are going to be, but I am well positioned to
slot them in,
any type of change in capability. And one of the most important things, again, now is, well, let's look at the organization. If I make a change in how payments are handled,
right,
does that have a cascading effect across the organization? In most cases, it would not. But the way we write the software often is in such a way that if we make a change to the way payments are handled, now all these other capabilities that theoretically are unrelated, now they break.
Is there a link in the way that the payment software, the module in the system, whatever you want to call it, the microservice, is there a compile time component boundary that suddenly breaks as a result? Or how would I write my software, my module in such a way that one service doesn't break and doesn't cause cascade when I introduce another or when I change something in the way payments works, for example?
I mean, honestly, I think that the biggest thing that we run into is a misunderstanding of the DRIVE principle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't repeat yourself. And so
I'm sorry, what?
Don't repeat yourself.
I'm sorry, what?
Don't repeat yourself.
Oh,
except
that.
Now I'm doing it.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah.
So we have taken that. So what that principle was, if you kind of go back to the first place that it was really referenced in a formal way, it was in the Pragmatic Programmer.
Right.
And the Pragmatic Programmer said, you know, every piece of knowledge should have a single authoritative representation. It did not say that every piece of code should have a single authoritative representation. There's a very subtle distinction between those two things. You know, knowledge could be represented in a, you know, in a consistent way across a lot of different things that, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, that thing over there is the same as that thing over there.
Right.
Yes, you know, in terms of the source code artifact that was produced, you are correct. But that knowledge is consistent across the system. So what do we get from that? Well, we get this idea that any code duplication whatsoever is evil.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultimate that we are trying to strive for is reuse, right? I mean, you know, you say the word reuse around any IT executive, they get really happy. It's like, oh, reuse. That means I'm going to spend less money because that thing that we built, we're going to keep using that thing over and over and over and over again. And when you think, let's say, when I see use the same thing over and over and over again in all these different contexts,
right.
I see coupling.
Yeah.
I see that we have now created this piece of software that now all these different things that want to evolve independently, they all come together at this one point.
And they're linked against it.
And they're linked. In some cases, they are absolutely, you know, compile time dependent upon the structure of that
module,
or that code,
yeah,
whatever it component module, whatever word we're going to use for it. And so like when you look at that at scale, when I go out in organizations, it's, oh, like, well, all the customer stuff is going to be here,
mm-hmm.
and all the stuff related to, you know, orders is going to be here. Right. All right. How many things are concerned about customer? Everything's concerned about customer. All right, so how many of those things actually use the customer module or the customer service? All of them do, right? So now we've got this distributed system of all these quote-unquote microservices, and yet every single microservice is dependent upon this microservice and this microservice over here. So every time this microservice changes, all the microservices end up changing. And that's way harder because now you don't even have a compiler to help you.
Right, way harder. And so we talk about consumer-driven contracts and things like that. And these are ways of regaining some of the confidence that the compiler gives you at the inter.
Yeah, I mean, there are tools that give you some of what the compiler can help you to do from the perspective of,
but it is hard.
Not hurting yourself.
Yeah.
And it's not as strong of a contract as the semantics of a particular programming language and what's allowed and what's not, but it's better than nothing at all, and it's certainly better in my mind than sort of, you know, very strict versioning type strategies where it's like, okay, we're all going to use version 1, except this one's going to use version 2, and then, well, we don't like version 2 anymore, we're going to do version 3, and before long you have a team that's supposed to be supporting like 4 or 5 different versions of an API in production, and they're constantly pulling their hair out
because even databases aren't good at versions, you know. It seems crazy to make.
Well, we bolt that particular semantic on, and you know, when we're trying to do optimistic concurrency, we put version columns and tables, right. And then we have like semantics that are built on top of that inside ORMs, and as long as those things work the way they're supposed to, everything's fine.
Today,
but then today
in this for this hour,
right?
You know, assuming the requirements haven't changed, and there's not this undue side effect over here that it is working. Absent the context of,
but at the end of the day, collaboration across the teams,
yeah,
is the thing that makes all this work. And when you put all of the burden for a particular concern organizationally on a single team that's responsible for a single, we'll say, service, then that becomes a very risky situation, and it becomes a bottleneck to, like, one of the reasons that we say we want to do, say, microservices is that we want to be able to deliver services, you know, independently, autonomously. Well, if every time you deliver, you have to go check and see what's going on with the customer service, then all of a sudden your autonomy has been limited by that. And conversely, like, okay, every time the customer service wants to deliver, all of a sudden there's this cascading effect right. across all of these teams. And we say, gosh, it was way easier when we were in the monolith.
I think you had a great tweet about this. You had a great tweet that something to the effect of if you have to deploy four different microservices, one in a particular order right after the other, you know, and then start
save yourself some pain and put it all back in a monolith.
Yeah. And just do that. It's easier
because you're not getting any of the benefits that you were going after. And you're still getting all of the costs.
Right.
Because, you know, a distributed systems architecture is more expensive before you ever get started than a non-distributed architecture because of all the different failure modes and, you know, interconnections, behaviors that can emerge. Like I tell people all the time, if you're going to build, you know, you're going to build a distributed system, you have to realize that the complexity of reasoning about that system, of troubleshooting that system, understanding what it does and why it does it, that increases at a super linear rate to the number of nodes in the system, right? So, and then the other way I say that for people who don't want to think about what super linear means, like the more nodes, the more microservices you have, the worse it gets faster.
and this is, of course, our friend Charity. This is her position, which is observe everything. It's the only way you're going to be able to figure this out later, and you will need to figure it out later. Mm-hmm. Okay, going back to the component boundaries and microservices. Let's say I've got service A and service B, and one is I need the customer module, right? I've got the customer module, and in order to do work over here in the payment processing or work over here in the fulfillment catalog, whatever, I need to make calls to the customer module. Well, one way I can ask questions of that customer module is to make an HTTP call, right?
Sure.
I could call SOAP endpoint. I could do RPC. Is RPC, you know, does that give me an easier path forward, or what's the alternative? Like, what is request response versus what? Right.
Well, I mean, I think it looks that way, deceptively.
Right.
That, you know, if I take what would have been a method call, and then I tease the system apart at that point and I turn it into a network call, then it's like,
this will
okay,
be fine.
I understand what's going on. I'm going to make a call. I'm going to wait. It's going to respond back. Maybe there's some failure modes that I'm going to think about, some retries, or rub a circuit breaker on it. Everything will be fine. But ultimately, there are just as many potential failure modes that you can run into in that situation than if you use a more decoupled, asynchronous architecture, whether you're using messaging to do that or you're using some of the more recent reactive programming models to achieve that. I mean, I honestly, there are really interesting technical pros and cons to look at. But when I step back of it again from the architectural big picture and the things that are actually causing organizations to succeed or fail, I don't really care which one you use. Just use the one that you pick well. Mm-hmm. And I think that making sure that you keep business processes appropriately decoupled. And I say business process, I don't mean the software that implements it. I mean the business processes themselves. Keep those appropriately decoupled so that when you build the software, you can, you know, basically switch into sort of a tell, don't ask scenario. You know, instead of me saying, okay, I'm going to reach out to this component and say, hey, would you please do this thing for me?
Right.
As opposed to, okay, I'm going to tell the world, hey, I did this thing. And then somebody, you know, sitting up here looking at the system as a whole knows that, oh, when it tells the world that it did this thing, this other thing should see that and react.
Okay.
And respond to that in some way and take another action. And there's this kind of choreography that's happening where as components are telling the world through events that they have done something, other components are reacting to that. And the component that published has really no understanding of how its events are being reacted to. And the event and the components that are reacting really have no understanding of why those events were being produced the way they were being produced, they just, oh, this person changed their address. I need to go do X, Y, and Z because of that. I don't care how it happened. I don't care why it happened. I just need to react to it. And so in that kind of a world, you create now a behavioral decoupling that says, all right, when this particular business process that's, you know, when we look at the way the humans would do it manually, mm-hmm. works completely independently and orthogonally to this other one over here.
Right.
Now the software starts to behave in a similar way. And what is the advantage of that? Well, now when this organization over here says, you know, we're going to change the process, we're going to make it more efficient, or we're going to offer this new capability that we didn't offer before.
Add a new process somewhere else.
Yeah. I don't have to now go touch everything in the world to make that possible. I just go do it. And then now that new process is publishing new events.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's publishing the new events with the old events. Sometimes it changes them. And the components that were reacting to the old events, if they're not being published anymore, guess what? They don't do anything. And that may be okay. But in a world where that's tightly coupled, you don't have that option.
Right. And so the benefit of that approach is that now I can add new things adjacent to existing processes, and they can also listen for these events.
Yeah.
And they can, so they don't, nothing has to change in the system for them to be, for these new things to be able to work with that system.
Yeah. Anytime you have a new capability that wants to respond to an existing event, you just go build the thing.
Right.
And nothing else needs to know or care about that. And if you decide once you built that thing that, you know what, we don't really need that. Throw it away.
Yeah.
And nobody knew it existed in the first place, and nobody knows that it's gone.
That's the Fred George's, you know, developer advocate. He talks about how microservices are small enough that you could build them and get them out there, and if nobody needs them, just throw them away. You can just take them, you just decommission them, and nobody will be using them, and you can just throw them away, right? Like they're,
yeah, I think it's a very powerful idea that people take and abuse, unfortunately. Yeah, absolutely. Just like any other idea that we come up with in software, people can take and abuse. But I think there's a lot of notions that have been tossed around in the microservices world that have value that people have misunderstood and then done, you know, terrible things with. Just kind of like agile.
Or I was going to say, what we're describing actually just sounds superficially kind of like ESBs, right? You have an event bus off of which things are listening. But of course, people have done terrible atrocities in the name of ESBs as well. So it's important to separate the concept from the code.
Yeah, the technology, the enterprise service bus technology is not, it's morally, you know, like what's the word I'm looking for? It's neutral. Like it's not good or bad. It's not evil or good. It's like, and there's a lot of useful patterns that exist inside that technology, which, you know, as it turns out, looks suspiciously like a lot of the things that you would use to build like an API gateway.
Oh,
and so it's really no surprise that like you see a lot of the former vendors that focused on ESBs have now kind of rebranded a lot of their technology. So now we're an API gateway for the cloud.
MuleSoft and MuleSoft Galaxy. For
even example. Though fundamentally, most of the components under the hood haven't changed because they're useful in that context.
Yep.
But the converse of that is, well, if that's true, then it means I can abuse the API gateway pattern just as much as I can abuse the ESB pattern.
Yeah. And hopefully we don't get WS star out of the gateway stuff soon.
Yes, God help us.
Well, my friend, I think we covered enough. I think we got just enough there.
This was a fun and surprising conversation. I had no idea it was going to go the directions.
Did we go deep enough?
That it did. But I thought I think we've probably covered enough that people are going to have things to react to and questions to ask. And then maybe we come back and do another one.
I'd love to. You're always welcome, of course. And I also think people, if people like this, if people like this discussion and they got something out of it, and I think they will, they're probably going to want to get more. I know of another great podcast focused on architecture that I'm a big fan of. I listen routinely. Can you tell us about that one? What's your podcast?
Yeah, so a couple years ago, I started Software Architecture Radio, primarily just because I wanted to have conversations with smart people about architecture that might be valuable to others. We had a good start out of the gate, and then we've been a little slow over the past year. But we just produced a really interesting episode with my friend Brian Sletten about WebAssembly, which
that was a very good one.
If you're not paying attention to WebAssembly, you should at least take a look at it and have it on your radar, because I think there's going to be some interesting and important things that are kind of come out of that space. But that's the kind of stuff that we talk about. And I'm working on right now getting a few more episodes queued up. So if you, whatever your favorite podcast aggregator thing is, whether it's iTunes or Overcast or anything like that, you search for Software Architecture Radio, we're there. If you just want to look on the web, it's one of those cute.io domains. So softwarearchitecturerad.io. So aww, like radio at the end.
That's adorable.
It's so adorable, right? So, so yeah, absolutely would love to have more listeners and more feedback on who do you want to hear from and what types of topics would you like us to cover, because I'm happy to talk about anything that, you know, listeners from an architecture perspective would be interested in.
And I like to think that what he lacks in quantity of episodes, he more than makes up for in quality. So
thank you, Josh. I appreciate that.
Definitely a recommended listening for you, dear listener. All right, brother. Where can our audience find you on the internet? Are you out there?
Unfortunately. So, probably the easiest ways to find me are two. If you do the Twitter thing that many of us still do, I am M. Stein. And I spell Stein, S-T-I-N-E, which is much more rare than the other spelling that people are familiar with, but it's out there. And so Twitter. And then I have a website that is just mattstein.com, all one word. And basically all of my articles, videos, book, you know, all the stuff that I have produced that might be interesting is kind of aggregated there. So it's like, hey, what did Matt say about X? That if it's not on that website, I probably didn't say anything about it. And then towards the bottom, I try to keep a running list of different conferences and events that I'll be at if you want to say hi.
And you're definitely out and about. I see you at a ton of conferences.
Yeah.
Like this one, for example, that we're at right now.
Indeed.
In Johannesburg.
Bringing the Spring One love to South Africa.
Absolutely. All righty, buddy. Thank you so much for joining me. And
thank
for
you,
listening.
Fun times.
Thanks for hanging, and we'll see you next time.
All right.
Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at STARUXMAN on Twitter, where of course my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/JoshLong for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.